probably should have known that there was a public process, but I'm not inclined to suggest that we go. I mean, let's do a good job and let's hear key affected parties in the process. So we, depending on how we go, we've had a chance to read it yet, ask the board to make a presentation on the basis of the written thing, if that's acceptable to members.
I find a little bit difficult to comprehend. In the presentation of the bill, there was a certain amount of consultations that took place prior to this. And right through, we were reading about, you know, people submitting and putting in forward, which I believe is very concrete proposals in terms of some minor changes here and there which have not been addressed in here. And my problem is, personally, I don't know whether you have had access to it, it refers to a lot of other documentations. I talk about the FAA audits and the Chicago conventions. Now, we haven't seen that, and I can't even comment or even relate to it in any sense of the word. And my question to you, Chair, is whether, if we do go through this process today, there can't be rather time for those people with have the access to that to sit with the department and actually check whether to see whether they are valid or not. Because we can't really comment on that. I don't know whether you agree, Chair.
You're raising a correct point. What I was about to say was, okay, so I'm just first of all trying to list what we've got in front of us. So we've got PowerPoint, which is coming up. We've got a substantial written document, which has been around for a while now. I think there was an earlier version, and now there's been a supplement. And we've had that document. It came in on basically on time. We've also got a brief thing, which again, I think we're just seeing for the first time today from the Cape Bar Council, a brief input. And I'm inclined again to say let's accept it, even though it's extremely late, but let's accept it. And let's see if we can't make time this morning. It looks brief and it looks like it's dealing with a couple of technical matters. Okay. Now, I also understand from the officials from the department that in particular in regard to the very substantial document from the Airlines Association, that there has been, over the last period, engagements. And I understand that a lot of the fiddly detail, but important detail, has been sorted out. That's what they tell us, but we would need, I mean, that's what I've been told informally, but from both sides, by the way, from the department as well as from the Airlines Association. But it would be useful, I think, also then to hear from the department as we proceed, but also just to confirm. And then I think it's there that also all of these other, because you're right, it refers to, I mean, it's all based in conventions, international, a lot of it's based in international conventions, so huge amounts of detail and paperwork, and obviously we're going to find it very difficult to do justice to that. And I think our job is really to make sure that the key parties have a chance to raise their concerns. We're going to rely on their respective competences in terms of international conventions and so on. We're not going to be able to do justice to that. Our main job, I think, is to make sure that the key parties have a chance to raise robustly whatever their concerns might be, and for us to do justice to that and make up our minds as best as possible on the basis of that. So you're right. There's, underlying this is a whole lot more stuff. So any questions at this point about procedure? It's hard to know exactly how long all of this is going to take. We were hoping to be able to complete this week, and that might still be possible, but I suppose we can't tell until we've started. Any questions about what's being proposed about how we proceed this morning? Seems like it's okay. Okay, so then over to yourselves. You'll introduce its our colleagues from Weather Wenzel, who will introduce themselves and their team.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, firstly, thank you very much for the opportunity to make these submissions. I'm Hayden Davis, and I'm a partner at Weather Wenzel, where, amongst other things, we specialise in aviation law. Sitting next to me is the Chief Executive Officer of the Airlines Association of Southern Africa, John Morrison, who also happens to be the Chairman of the Aviation Coordination Services Proprietary Limited. And we're making the submissions on behalf of both of those organisations, those entities today. Also with me on my left is my colleague Zinat Tassou, and behind her, Pamela Stein, who also work at Weber Wenzel in one capacity or another. To confirm what the chairman said, there was a lengthy meeting between ourselves and the Department of Transport on Friday, and that was convened at their request as a consequence of having received our submissions. And the upshot of that is that, in principle at least, much of the 102-page submission has been agreed, and they agree with our point of view, although obviously we'd like to see how that manifests itself in the written form. Before we say that we are happy that our comments are correctly reflected. So the consequence and the upshot of that is that what we're going to be doing today is really 20 slides, just 20 slides. They're going to focus on really two key issues, and that's what we really want to focus in on today and not get bogged down in the detail of the 102-page document, although, of course, we're happy to try and field any questions as best we can on that.
Mm-hmm. Let me just, on the first matter that you're raising, let me ask from the department side of things, at this stage, those discussions that were held, are there some textual references that are available at this point? So, because their point is right, that in principle there seems to be an agreement and a congruence of minds, but the angel is in the generalities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in principle, yes, we have had a lengthy discussion, and a lot of it dealt with construction of grammar, definitions. There wasn't any principal issues, and I think the principal issues that are going to be discussed today were the issues that we did not sort of meet heads with as such. All the other issues we have agreed to in principle in terms of addressing the grammar issues, addressing the context and the definitions, unless I'm wrong.
Okay. What I'm asking is, how soon can we see some textual reflection of that? The short answer is in a while, not immediately. Okay, it seems.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman, the outstanding item, which is the board, affects all the other issues we discussed. There's a link in terms of cross-referencing and stuff, so it all depends on
we
the outcome.
Have a clear
day, and then we can part the way going forward.
Okay. I think I understand.
I mean, so clear these two issues, you're right, that there's a flow-through effect, and it's really important that we get our point across and we get this right for the good of all concerned. The way we're going to deal with it is that if I can just skip, yes, can have a look at the PowerPoint presentation. There's four points there, but we really want to deal with the middle two. Those are the two key points. Just reading from the second point, and I'll go back then to the first. The creation of multiple centres of power. What that really deals with is who's doing what as far as safety and security are concerned, and drilling down, it really goes to what is the CAA and how is it constituted. And we'll be talking about that. And we divide it into three, so my colleague Zeynep Dasu will be dealing with that specific issue. The third point is the position and powers of the National Civil Aviation Security Coordinator. And, well, quite simply, we say there's no need for such a thing, and I'll be dealing with that point as part of the PowerPoint presentation. My colleague Pamela Stone will be dealing briefly with the Accident Investigation Board, which we concur with the principle, and indeed we say it's an international obligation to give effect to that. And we've also just noted a few general concerns. But it's really about the middle two points. That's the core issues.
So, you ready to go?
Okay. So, without further ado then, if we could... Zeynep will address the structure of the CAA and the multiple centres of power. Just while she's readying herself, if you have a look at that chart at the moment, that's what we say, diagrammatically, you've got in the present bill. That's what it looks like. And you'll be seeing later that we're saying it should look anything other than that. And the reason is quite simple, and that is because it is a confusing picture about too many people doing too many things and not being sure what it is exactly that they are doing. And we'll be critiquing each of those. I'll be dealing with point four, the coordinator, and Zeenat, when she begins, will be dealing with the structure of the Civil Aviation Authority and how we see that looking. Of course, we haven't had the benefit of seeing the CAA submission, which was handed in this morning, and we would like to obviously get a copy of that later and just reserve the right to add anything additional that may arise from that.
Good morning. As Hayden alluded to in the previous slide, the bill creates these various centres of powers in the form of functionaries, such as the coordinator, the director, the board, and the actual body, the authority, in relation to oversight, critical oversight responsibilities that South Africa has obligations in terms of international conventions. I think as a starting point, the one critical oversight function being the safety oversight function, and just a little bit of history around that. My instructions are, because I haven't had that experience 15 to 20 years ago, the structure of the authority was such that it was reposed in the Department of Transport initially, with one functionary being the director, who was responsible for safety and, I presume, security oversight generally. He was directly he had a direct reporting line to the minister, who was the obvious state functionary who carried out the obligations of the state in terms of the international conventions. That worked fine for a while until, you know, until industry basically wanted input in this process, because what was happening is that there was very autocratic structure in place, and it seemed that essentially a civil servant was determining major policies that affected and the industry as a whole. After deliberations and discussions, I think the state conceded that there needed to be at certain levels industry participation. I think there were attempts at advisory panels being formulated, which didn't really bear much fruit. And then we saw a very important development in keeping with good corporate governance principles, in keeping with PFMA, in keeping with openness and transparency, and in keeping with the trends of other regulatory bodies in this country, the formation of the South African Civil Aviation Authority in terms of an Act of Parliament, and the establishment of the governing board of the authority. This was good. This was a good development, because what it meant is that the board then composed of various industry players, people with diverse experience in the aviation field, together with DOT participants and, you know, broader civil society members. Our client's submission is that it was a step in the right direction, and obviously this authority had to ground itself and evolve. What then happened was a kind of blip in the system where, as a result of certain very standard audits, certain concerns were raised that our legislation was not clear enough as to who has the ultimate oversight function, whether it's the board, whether it's the director, whether it's the CEO of the board. Can the minister merely step in and over overrule the board in exigency situations related to safety and security, which in some parts were well-grounded criticisms of our legislation, but in other parts were not very well-grounded, and we could show that actually our legislation actually functioned very efficiently in the circumstances, but there was room for improvement. Hence, the move afoot to rehaul our aviation legislation. With respect to rehaul aviation legislation is a huge, huge exercise which needs to take into account various areas. Industry attitudes, international best practice, because this field is developing globally. There is no fixed right solution, no neat pigeonholing of how your authority should look. I'll give you, for example, in the U.S., is a very particular structure that they use that's endemic to their country and their laws and the way they operate. Similarly, Australia, which until very recently, I believe, had a board structure, but that has evolved and changed because of challenges that they've met recently. New Zealand has a board structure. The UK has a board structure. But there isn't the, you know, it's not a perfect fit. It's endemic to each jurisdiction. And basically what I'm saying is that South Africa has to find its own footing in this regard. It was necessary to actually go down this route and rehaul our legislation. But I think it's been a rushed job. I think we submit that it's a rushed job. We submit that there should have been broader industry participation, more time spent on it. And I believe that the policies should have been worked out in detail before pen was put to paper. I believe that the confusion that has arisen out of the centres of power issue, which is, I think, the core niggly issue about this bill, could have been avoided had there been perhaps a green and white paper process, and the department had come out with a well-established policy as to how we want to look. The resulting piece of legislation has created a very confusing, and I submit, more confusing and in fact very detrimental piece of legislation that will invite criticism from the various auditing bodies, international auditing bodies. We have made this particular point in our various submissions since April, and apart from very slight amendments, our criticism has not been addressed. The fundamental criticism being that there are too many centres of power. I'll now explain exactly what I mean. Like I said, the board and the director have overlapping managerial and safety oversight functions in relation to the authority. The authority, the board, and the coordinator and the director have overlapping security oversight functions. The director, the board, and the coordinator account to the minister separately. So there's no accountability processes or mechanisms built into this bill dealing with the interrelationship between these various centres of powers. What you're basically going to find happening is you're going to be finding these little fiefdoms being created. Everyone thinks that they have the ultimate oversight oversight responsibility, and hence conflict, and hence it's inefficient and ultimately will compromise our safety oversight obligation that we have in terms of international conventions. The last point being the coordinator being housed in the Department of Transport, which is just ludicrous situation to have. I mean, we have all the other functionaries being the board and the director housed within the authority, and then we have the coordinator housed within the Department of Transport. The problems with this, as is evident, is that no party is ultimately accountable, which is a problem. for the authority's ultimate authority's function. So we have an authority which says the authority must be, must have the ultimate safety oversight. Who runs this authority? Is it the board? Is it the director? It's not clear from this act who runs the authority. There's no clear chain of command as required by the various auditing committees, international auditing committees. There's room for disputes, like I've just mentioned, over the scope of power. You know, you'll have these little fiefdoms being created. Everyone thinks that they have the ultimate oversight. The room for dispute over the scope of power without the conflict resolution mechanism is detrimental. You don't want people fighting over the nitty-gritties when there's a major safety crisis looming in the aviation industry. And my last point being that the foreign and international concerns over the inefficiency of our system, the confusion and the counterproductivity of our bill will be very well-founded if it wasn't well-founded before with this new bill, if these things are not resolved. Next slide, Aidan. Sure.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add an additional comment, I'd like to go back to the graph, which is the proposed structure, if we could. I'd like to make one or two comments in a very simplified form and perhaps in a non-legal way. If one looks at the box there, which shows number 3, which shows the board of directors. The board of directors reports to the minister, but only in respect of corporate governance and human resources and strategic goals. And in box number 2, the director reports to the minister in respect of safety and security. The Civil Aviation Authority, the prime function of the Civil Aviation Authority is safety and security. So we now have a situation where the director no longer reports to the board, he goes directly to the minister. And if the board has, and as it should have, representation from the aviation industry, from civil aviation, and some experts, they're all bypassed, because the director reports directly to the minister. And the board only has partial authority in respect of corporate governance and human resources. And that clearly is a major concern for the industry. It's a board that's there in almost in name only, has no real responsibility. And there has been a suggestion that the board should be disbanded altogether. If that's the case, we're probably going back to where we were before the formation of the Civil Aviation Authority, when we had the Director of Civil Aviation within the Department of Transport reporting to the Minister. So it's a regressive step. It's going backwards, not forwards. And it takes the ability of the industry to be represented in civil aviation safety and security matters away from the industry. And there's no real way of having input as there is at the moment. So that's the main concern. Secondly, the box that's identified as number 4, coordinator, that is the safety and security coordinator, in case we're not all clear on that. And the proposal in terms of the bill is that the safety and security coordinator reports directly to the minister again in the DOT and not via the board of directors. And it really doesn't make any sense in terms of real corporate governance. And we believe that the coordinator, the safety coordinator, should be responsible for policy only, but that the implementation should be the responsibility of the Civil Aviation Authority. And I think they're the two kind of fundamental and simplistic but important key issues that's of concern to the aviation industry. We think that the safety and security coordinator should report to the Minister for Policy, and that the Civil Aviation Authority itself should have the responsibility through its board for the implementation of that policy. And we believe that's what's intended in the international conventions. Thank you, Chairman.
I think John kind of captured very, very short term exactly what the issues are broadly. I'll just get quickly into a few specifics about these various functionaries, these various centres of power, and what this bill has done to these various centres of power. We have what we call the authority. It's established, great. It's an established body. It's sitting there. It's a juristic person. But it begs the question as to who runs this authority. So we have this authority, which in my view at the moment is almost a rudderless institution, because nobody knows who runs it. My point being is that you have two potential bodies. You have the body of the director, which is an individual, and you have the board of. Basically, what this bill sought to achieve was it sought to denude the board of all safety and security oversight functions. And it wanted it to be mainly a board that's concerned with this very broad term, corporate governance issues. That in itself is a very woolly concept and hasn't been spelled out exactly what that means. But we presume it means like the day-to-day running of the company. And I think that's what probably the drafters of the bill wanted to achieve. And if that was the policy, fine, but this bill doesn't achieve that policy either. So that's a criticism against that, because if you read the sections around what the functions and the objects of the authority are, what the functions and the duties of the director are, and what the functions and the duties of, say, the coordinator are, and the functions and the objects of the board, you will see that there are major overlaps between all of these functions. And they're very broadly drafted, nothing specific, and it will leave room for a lot of dispute as to who's in charge of this authority. The board has ordinarily, in any structure, the board would lead the authority. If in a company law context you have a company, who leads the company? Not the CEO, not the chairman, it's the board. In most of our regulatory regimes in this country, from ICASA to the Maritime Safety Regulatory Body, the one feature that is consistent throughout is that those regulatory bodies are run by a board. They have a functionary involved in those bodies, but the functionary accounts to the board, and the functionary is part of the board, but ultimately it's the board that is the repository of the oversight functions of such regulators. There are exceptions to that rule, granted. But I think the trend in our democracy is to move towards an open system, accountability, broader participation, and the board system complements that, as opposed to having one autocratic person having all the power in the world without any duties to consult widely, no checks and balances, has one or two audits done on him by a very overworked Auditor General's office. It's merely, it's not a system that in our view certainly should be encouraged. We should be going towards a more open, accountable system. We'll have our detractors saying, well, that doesn't, that works counterproductive to our international obligations on safety oversight, because there must be a clear chain of command. Well, the board system doesn't work against them. It's not counterproductive. We've seen in many international jurisdictions that it works well, and it's a dynamic system. Manage it properly, have the clear objects and functions set out, and you will have an efficient system. You'll have the clear chain of command. coupled with good corporate governance principles that our democracy demands. I think it's just a knee-jerk reaction to wanting to go back to an old style of an autocratic system where, you know, there's no transparency, no interaction with the industry broadly, and that's just counterproductive. Briefly, who comprises the authority? It is not clear in the bill. The bill doesn't even say who comprises the authority. It should say specifically the authority comprises of employees, the director, the accident agency, in our view, the coordinator, etc. Why is that important? Because it's important to specify who is accountable for the authority's performance. Because the authority is a juristic person, it doesn't have a brain, a personality to do anything. Its personality is derived from the individual components of its makeup, and that is the board, primarily the director and its employees and functionaries within it. Again, the authority, the ability to perform, another big feature, just a niggly point here, but important, the ability, there's inconsistency in the drafting. In my knowledge, the only other act in this country that has extraterritorial jurisdiction, the only act, I believe, or functionary or body authority that has extraterritorial jurisdiction in this country would be the Competition Commission, whose fingers reach beyond our borders. To my knowledge, no other regulator has that type of reach. This act seems to give this authority that type of reach, and I'm not sure what is the policy consideration behind it. I'm not sure it's well thought out. I just think it's a mistake because there's a contradiction. And the contradiction is in clause 72.1, which specifically refers to the functions of the authority being performed in the Republic, so it's clearly stated that, and in 72.4 creates this extraterritorial reach of the authority beyond our borders. That needs to be looked at. The second big point, the overlap of the functions between the director and the board relating to the appointment of staff. It may seem a niggly little point, but important. If we are to say that the director has the final oversight over safety, how does he actually implement that? He'll have to appoint staff, he'll have to appoint investigators, he'll have to designate functionaries to fulfill the safety oversight obligation. This bill basically says that the board will have a final say over practically the appointment of staff. What if there's a dispute between the director and the board in relation, if the director feels he needs international skilled person in relation to a very technical safety matter, and your board says no, it's too expensive? Who's going to arbiter that type of dispute? That type of dispute can lead to a compromise of our safety standards in this country. So something as small as that hasn't been given much thought to. Another point is the funding of the authority. Just from a corporate governance perspective, we've raised issue as the authority has the ability to invest surplus cash. Is that a core function of the authority? Questionable. And also that the authority can derive money accruing from other sources. What does that mean? I mean, is that good corporate governance? Then another point is it relates to the punishment for misuse of the authority's names. There's, no terms of imprisonment or fine is prescribed. It's vague and uncertain and potentially unconstitutional, illegal, such a provision. So no thought to the detail of that. It's just a rushed job. Another point is the recovery of costs as a result of a ministerial order. Very important point. The minister has the power to issue ministerial orders in the interest of aviation safety and security. Very important power. We agree the minister should have that power. However, if the directive has major financial consequences, this act provides that the authority has to basically dig in its coffers to cover those costs. But this act allows the authority to the board to recover the costs from Parliament, but under certain circumstances, and those circumstances are very vague. For example, unclear what the authority should first do before it can recover from Parliament. And the second big point about that, very important for our clients, is that the board must seek to also recover these costs from industry participants. What does that mean? That term isn't even defined. And even if industry participants mean our client, there's been no consultation with our client on something that could affect them detrimentally financially in the future. Nothing's been spelled out in that regard. This is, for example, a clear example of the breach of participative democracy process in the passing of very far-reaching legislative provisions. Taking the next slide. On to the next functionary, which is the board. As I've alluded to before, the objects of the board are not clear. Again, attempt to denude the board of safety and security oversight is not achieved. That may have been the intention, but they didn't achieve that intention. As the board sets strategic, this concept of strategic goals of the authority, not a defined term. What does that mean? In my view, I could argue strategic goals is the safety and security oversight functions of the state, and therefore a clear overlap with the director and the coordinator's function. Safety and security oversight is the responsibility of the authority and not the responsibility of the director or the board. You see, we've created a little structure called the authority. The authority should be the repository of the oversight. Who runs the authority should be spelt out. So it's not the responsibility of any particular functionary, like the board or the director. It should be the object of the authority and the function of the authority, the safety and oversight functioning, and not of these two different functionaries. It's not clear how the board interacts with other functionaries, a point I made before in the event of disputes. All of these people have their own little fiefdoms of power. It could result in disaster. Can the director fulfill the safety oversight function if the board is responsible for income and expenditure of authority? It's great to put an oversight function in one person. But how does that person carry out that function? That person must have the ability to appoint staff, which this bill gives him, but, you know, staff needs to be paid. Can he make a decision about the payment of staff? No, he can't, because the board has that power. So what happens when there's conflict in that respect? And another very important point, composition of the board. With due respect, this has just been a very rushed attempt, a copy and paste job without thinking about the ramifications and learning from past experiences about how and who should we have on this board. This is a very specialized area. It's aviation. Presumably, whoever is sitting on that board must at least have two qualities: civil aviation experience or aviation experience generally, and corporate governance experience. Because you are sitting as a board, you have certain duties as a board member, so you must at least know how to manage something. The bill presently contemplates that only there can be a maximum of 7 board members, and I'm going to give you an absurd example that is actually set out in our full-on submissions. So you have 7 members of a board. Only 2 of them need have aviation experience. So it is possible that the 5 others just need to have what is termed business experience. What does that mean? Business, if I own a takeaway on the corner, I have business experience. Does that mean am I competent enough to sit on the board? I've surely, passed that one test, but I don't think that's what was intended, but the drafting achieves an absurd situation. Be clear who you want on your board. It should be technically competent, on the one hand, you know, people, and people with management experience. And I think we have an aviation industry that has that we can draw from in that respect. The board members...
Sorry, Chair, I just want to check in the bill itself, where does it talk about the business?
Can you?
No, I see page 39, I see chapter 5, but where does it necessarily talk about business?
Yes,
under subclause 4B, describes the spread of experience that is required. Yeah, and I think that's what you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Another criticism on the composition of the board is that, and I don't think that this again was intentional, but it seems as though the drafting has resulted in, you know, a board member's terms being, you know, could be extended indefinitely, which is not healthy. It's not a healthy situation. We should be having set terms for board members to rotate on. And I think that can be easily, I don't think that was intentional, but the drafting has achieved that. The other concern on the composition of the board is the quorum of the board and the voting of the board. The quorum of the board is 3 members. If you have 3 members at any meeting, the majority from the 3 members, if they vote, you know, it will be regarded as the resolution of that board, which is fine and I think is standard across the board. But if we have the absurd situation where you only have 2 members who have civil aviation experience, and the rest of the members may have other types of experiences listed on page 40, and there's again another absurd situation, but it's the jobs of lawyers to think about every hypothetical. So you have a board meeting with 3 people who do not have civil aviation experience. They can technically make a decision, a binding decision of the board, on a technical issue. Right? Now, again, I don't think it was an intended consequence, but that's what can be achieved, and I think a little more thought must go into safeguards in that respect. Hayden, the next slide. Okay.
There was a piece of legislation that was passed by this House some maybe a year or so ago, which generally looked at all these various parastatals, let's call them that, or government agencies of the department, whereby they were amended accordingly to see that both the composition and also relative aspects of its term, you know, in terms of reappointments, were addressed. Now, has that been taken into account? I think it was called the General Laws Amendment Bill. And if not, you know, then one needs to go back to that, because that would overarch, as I understand, the current legislation being put before us in this bill form, in this draft. And the department needs to just rectify, because, you know, I don't think it's necessary to comment on something here that might have been superseded. I don't know.
Well,
I just want to check.
I understand that act would have superseded the current acts, but once this act is passed, and if this act hasn't taken into account that act, this act would supersede that act. Yes. So you're right. I think maybe a comparison, and if you know, if they have taken into account.
Well, I mean, maybe the question is best answered by the DOT officials. In other words, did they take account of that Act of Parliament that you mentioned when drafting this?
Okay,
no problem. I just need to get to two more important slides. I'm going to skip the director because the slides will talk to itself, and I just need to get to one structure, the diagrams. This
part
is.
Part of what you're saying is confidential.
Yes, it's
on the big issue.
Yes.
deciding who should
Or
then it should even be the board's going to be compliant to corporate governance, then why do we need a board?
Absolutely.
An entity that is not transit, telecom, you need a board there to channel things. That functioning commercially on the market, so this is a regulatory entity, safety regulatory.
Yeah.
Therefore, a lot depends on what you're trying to do with the board, even when you need it. Sorry, I'm just interjecting two
things.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a quick comment. Effectively,
the bigger picture needs to be sorted out before we dive into too much of the detail just reinforces the point that we're perhaps not very clear what we're trying to do in the bigger picture. The structure, authority, who does what. And a lot of the detail is clearing that up.
Chairman, I think you're absolutely right. You're looking at the bigger picture, and what this bill seeks to do is to have a board that has no teeth, and all of the power then rests in the director and in the safety coordinator. Not jointly, but separately, and they report to the minister separately. And the whole of the main function of the Civil Aviation Authority is to control civil aviation safety and security. And it's going to be done by different people who've got power bases. And there's no access to those people to be able to, like there is through a board. So, yes, do we need the board? And we think we do. But I think you have...
I think you've preempted this potential model. No, it's fine. I think it's a good introduction to this. And do we need a board? And I think this is a potential model that could be mooted by the department to say, well, if there's all these confusing structures, why don't we just disband every one of them? We just have the minister, the director. Under the director, we have just a bunch of senior managers managing the authority. And the Auditor General looks after it all. The criticism around the structure is that there's too much, divergent responsibility on one person. It's a specialized industry. It needs input from the aviation industry. In fact, in order to fulfill an effective safety oversight, you're going to need the buy-in of the aviation industry. This system, with respect, existed 15 years ago. It existed. It may have not existed as a standalone authority, but at least for the first three blocks, it existed. It was inefficient, draconian, very closed. Industry never had a chance to input, and it led to a lot of tension. Why did we move away from the system? We moved away because of our open democracy principles, because of the PFMA, and because a lot of our regulatory bodies, not only our commercial state-owned entities, our regulatory bodies have boards. So ICASA, for example, is not a commercial entity. It's a regulatory-making body, but it has a board. And I think it's good to have a board because those board members are appointed for their varying skills and experiences. They are appointed and they give direction to that authority. So you're not having one person with limited experience being his own experience, not being able to liaise with anyone else and making serious policy decisions that affect the aviation industry as a whole. And that for me is the biggest downfall of the system. It's draconian, closed, no one can question it, except maybe the Auditor General, It doesn't allow for industry participation. It is not open democracy, the system. Your regulatory, well, that's just the submission we're making. Corporate governance is affected, it takes us, as I've just said, corporate governance is also affected by that. That's just the few criticism. I'm not even going on that onto that slide. You probably can read for yourself. Hayden, the next slide. Our client's proposal. Our client's proposal, if you can ignore the advisory panel block for the time being, would be simply this. You have the minister, you have the board who runs the authority, and you have each of these members in charge of the various functions of this authority. So you would have this director person in charge of the safety and perhaps even the security regulation group, and who would then account for his activities to the board, and you would have the board being directly accountable to the minister. You can build in, just to allay the department's fears in this regard, you can build in exigency provisions where you could perhaps have a direct report on purely safety issues, a direct report from the director to the minister in exigency situations, in emergency situations, if the board is too much of a convoluted process. But it shouldn't be a convoluted process. This system works well abroad. It works well with our other regulators. Why can't it work well here? Again, I need to point out that the whole move afoot in changing the structures was borne out by criticisms levelled as a result of an audit of a potential problem. It wasn't a criticism levelled as at what was actually happening or a problem that was existing. It was, you know, a what-if scenario. You don't have a direct chain of command. It was a reaction to a potential. It wasn't a reaction to, you have a terribly running CAA, it's horrible. In fact, the criticism was not even leveled at the practical running of the CAA. It was leveled at our primary legislation. So practically, our CAA was running efficiently. Legislation was criticized because it appeared to have this overlap function. And that brings me to the end of this. Just in conclusion, I'd like to say that currently we have the Aviation Act and we have the SAACA Act, the Authority Act. Fine and well, there was criticisms leveled at the potential overlaps of those acts, but in whole our acts are functioning perfectly well. It's not broken beyond repair. And I think as a direct knee-jerk reaction to the auditing processes last year, I think we're rushing things unduly. We should think about these policy, big, broader policy decisions carefully. We should have more interactions with industry, and we should come out with a better policy and not rush things as we're doing at the moment. That's the end of my section.
The criticism that was leveled about the authority, its accountability, etc., and the conflict that might occur, where was that raised? In the FAA report, or was it in the ICAO audit, or where? You know, we just need to know where it was sourced from, that particular thing, so I can...
No, the criticism that's being levelled now about these conflict between the centres of power is a criticism levelled at the bill as it's currently drafted. The ICAO report, the ICAO report and the FAA report, when they did their usual audits, looked at our current legislation and said our current legislation seems to create these overlapping functions. Yes, seems to create.
Chairperson, just one final point. If we could go back to the slide with the proposed alternative. I think Zina did say that for the moment, ignore the box on the right, which is described as the advisory panel. In fact, I think we'd like to say we really don't want that. It's really just a, if the portfolio committee couldn't accept the recommendations as you see it without that box, it might be an alternative to bring it in, but we really don't think we need it. We need a formal structure of the minister, a board, a management, and then various groups as described on that.
Respect to legislation, because obviously that's not our job in a sense, to make doubly sure that it was your version is things were working fine in practice and so on, but there was an audit concern, and that's what's driving all of this, an audit concern that the principal act or acts, because we're dealing with two acts I think, might in some eventuality, and that's what we do need to look at, all of us need to bear in mind. So I think that maybe not deal with it right now, but I mean that's central to the issue, is to actually let's see what they are saying, and one, whether we just patriotically ignore what external forces say or whether we take seriously what they're saying and see whether, because that's what's driving the amendments, essentially, that issue. This current legislation in front of us. However imperfect it may be. So we need to keep that in mind. But I'll play you in a bit later, and I think once we've listened to Stuart.
Clarity. I mean, reading through the submission, the structure that you're proposing there, did I read somewhere that it might have been a model that was used in other countries where it's working well and acceptably well? If so, is that the case, or have you taken some sort of a hybrid relating to the current stuff in our country and tried to structure it around that? I just wanted to get, you know, some sort of an idea about that. There was mention of the UK and New Zealand type model, and I'm just wondering, is that it, or, you know, is this something more, you know, relevant?
It wouldn't mirror those models to the T, but overall it does capture those particular models. I think specifically New Zealand, if I can recall properly, and the UK, John, are you? The UK model is based in most part on this particular model. Yeah, the UK model.
Yes, Chair, it's not necessarily a question, of course, is that one would have expected that when the department comes up with these policies, would actually have spoken to the industry itself. And I was of the opinion that in the beginning, when the presentation was made, there was some meeting last week on Friday or so with the department. But now, given this presentation that looks like there are quite a good number of differences, I actually just wanted clarity whether on Friday the industry, the department have actually resolved to differ such that we need to come in as a committee to assist, or there is still any room for them to come closer to each other, because the kind of difference that I'm seeing in the presentation, although is that most of them are consequential, as you're saying, from the bigger policy position, really needs to be addressed in terms of the relationship that the department is having with the industry. Thanks.
Let's hold on. I mean, that's the big question, and let's hold on. So let's familiarize our
What I'm saying is boring, so it it's losable, but anyway. Get a sense of the second big issue that I think we're about to hear about. Then check where we are. And I think that's the point in which to play in the department and just get a sense of their broad responses to what we're hearing. Okay. Can we move along then? But hold on to that, because that's the big question, exactly. Can we move along? Okay.
Okay.
Thanks,
Ed. Okay. I'll with pleasure answer those questions later, but I'll take my lead from the chair, and we'll just stick with let's call it really the second big issue, second and final big issue, the other issue being of less importance. You'll see there, just to remind you, remember, just cast your mind back to that very first diagram. The coordinator is housed, remember, out on the side there within the Department of Transport. Section 143 refers to this person being an employee, so we're talking about an individual, not an institution. And not housed within the authority, the Civil Aviation Authority. Now, you don't have to take my word for it, but if you read section 72, and you don't need to turn to it, it's very short and simple. The Civil Aviation Authority has the function of conducting the safety and security oversight of civil aviation in the Republic. It's pretty clear, isn't it? I thought so. Let's have a look at the role of the coordinator. So these are the responsibilities. Now, just ignore for the moment what I put in brackets. Firstly, and they're all listed there, these responsibilities in 143 of the bill. Develop civil aviation security policies and enforcement strategies. Okay. Now, the brackets are roles of the Civil Aviation Authority, which just for convenience, I've taken across from Section 72, and I've put them next to one another. Develop effective enforcement strategies. It's the same. This is the same thing. The next one, compile, revise, coordinate, monitor, and enforce National Aviation Security Plan. I think it should be program is the proper terminology, but the bill refers to plan. Assess security decisions taken by industry. Review civil aviation security system. And then in brackets, this is one of the items listed under the function of the Civil Aviation Authority. Review the system of civil aviation security. Next item, review and assess international security developments. That's what the coordinator is supposed to be doing. And in brackets, conduct assessment of international security developments. And the point is simple. Who the hell knows what they are supposed to be doing? There's a massive overlap on anyone's version of events, which logic alone would say that just should not be. Now, you may be saying to yourself, well, it doesn't really matter. If two people are doing one thing, well, that's great, isn't it? Because maybe there's more chance of getting it done. And I suppose there's a logic to that thought. But I would say that will have serious implications. The reason it's going to have serious implications is because this is an aviation industry. We're not acting down here in isolation. We fly places. People fly here. It matters. That's why people from America come down here as a matter of public record, and they do audits on our legislation, on the way we do things, on safety, on security. The European Community does things like that. ICAO does that. The Department of Transport will be able to confirm all of that. And we've had some recent visits in the past 12 months or so. So it matters. So we can't make this legislation in isolation. Referring to the top of the slide and re-emphasizing, remember that 72, the authority has the function of conducting safety and security oversight of civil aviation. And I've just shown to you that on the wording of this, not my opinion, on the wording of this, there is a clear overlap, confusion of responsibility. Well, as you will see, that will lead to an inevitable power struggle between the authority and the coordinator. Because, I mean, if I'm an aviation, if I'm an airline, who do I write to? Do I write to both of them? What if one says yes and the other says no? I mean, how am I supposed to plan and operate in that kind of environment? It doesn't work. It's not clear where ultimate accountability for proper discharge of the functions and exercise of power lies. So one may say, oh, it's them, and the other one may say it's them, and maybe they both say it's them and come to differing decisions. And Annex 17 to the Convention on International Civil Aviation. Now, it's basically the Chicago Convention that we acceded to. We became bound to, I think, probably back as far as 1947, I think, is when we actually signed up to it. It's a long thing, but it's effectively part of our law. I think it's a schedule to the Aviation Act. And Annex 17, it deals with, I've got the document here, it's not that long, but and you're welcome to have a look at it if you wish, but it deals with security. And you'll note, and I quote, Annex 17 to the Convention on International Civil Aviation provides that national aviation security program is to be developed, implemented, and maintained by an appropriate authority. Now, the way we've got it at the moment, that's kind of like what the coordinator is going to do. For goodness knows what reason. Why? That's one of the things he or she is supposed to be doing. It's quite obvious, in terms of Annex 17, that the appropriate authority could, and I would submit should, be the Civil Aviation Authority. It's logical. Why on earth is that specific aspect, together with some duplicate aspects, going to be dealt with by someone else sitting in the Department of Transport? I have no idea. I can't answer that question, and you'd have to put that to the DOT representatives. Now, and I'm nearing the end, so I think I've made my point. But so there's incurable overlaps between the functions and powers of the authority and functions and the powers of the coordinator. That's a fact. It's not an opinion. Provisions in the bill pertain to the coordinator fly in the face of common sense and contrary to our international obligations. And just think to yourself, well, okay, we've got international obligations. Does it really matter? Yes, it matters. If you fail audits from other countries, say from America, the consequences in simple terms could be a freeze on flights. Okay, so South African Airways will not be flying additional flights to the European community because we have been downgraded for some reason. Why? Because we don't meet certain requirements. They may be safety related. There may be any number of reasons. One of the reasons may be that our legislation and regulations do not give a clear line of authority as to who is doing what for whom and who is responsible. It is important and it matters in the real world. And just to start, this is the final slide from my perspective. In practical terms, an individual today in the Department of Transport has just been named as coordinator. I've read to you at the beginning what that person's supposed to be doing. How they're going to do it? How are they going to do it? It's one person. I'm no doubt the DOT have got other functions to perform, other things to do, and now you have given obligations to one person, and you've given them as well, of course, to the Civil Aviation Authority, just to add to the confusion, and you're asking that person to discharge obligations that are not possible practically to discharge. It's impossible. Unless, of course, you're going to basically duplicate the CAA function now within the Department of Transport. And then you don't need the CAA either. So you can get rid of the board and you'll get rid of the CAA. It's unacceptable and it's going backwards. It's not in accordance with our international obligations and it's going to have a very real effect on airlines. And when it has a real effect on airlines, it has a real effect on this country and its economy. And finally, just to wrap up, it makes the point which I think I've already made. Ultimately, duplication. Yes, but there's no need for any duplication. The CAA is quite capable of performing this function and has successfully in the past, and therefore is a waste of resources a waste of resources is inevitable. I would suggest that's the best possible outcome, a waste of resources. It's going to be far worse than that. And finally, there's no mention, this person, whoever it may be, seems to be playing a role of importance. There's no mention of minimum qualifications, expertise or experience. So you may as well appoint me and I would have no idea what to do whatsoever. So those are my heartfelt views, because I worked a long time in the aviation industry with the likes of John Morrison, and I really implore you that we cannot allow legislation with these type of provisions to go through. It will have a practical impact on the industry and worse, on the country. And that's it from me.
And then accident safety.
Yes, we'd just like, of course, we just got a, let's call it a secondary, but still important point, where I think we've got, for the most part, a great deal of consensus with our colleagues at the Department of Transport. But we'd just like to emphasise one or two things, because this is in many ways bringing us in line with, again, with our international obligations, and that's what the Department of Transport are doing on the topic that's going to be addressed now, which is accident investigation.
Okay. Is that okay?
Yes. Good. Thanks, Pamela. Sorry, there are only really a couple of issues around the structure. And the first one being is that the annex, which this particular structure is based on, Annex 13 to the Convention, requires that this investigating authority has complete independence. The Aviation Safety Investigation Board investigates accidents and serious incidents. And the Convention requires it must be completely independent. Now, the bill sets out to do that, but unfortunately then, in the same breath, it undermines that independence in quite a number of respects. And all I want to say to you is I urge you just to have a look at the way in which it's undermined. We deal with each clause. It's starts at page 24 to page 25 of our submissions. the most significant undermining of independence is the issue of when the ASI board may investigate aircraft accidents or incidents. And as the bill is currently drafted, it says, if so requested by the minister. Now we say this board must be able to investigate accidents and incidents of its own accord. It must decide. It cannot wait for the minister. It cannot depend on the minister. The next issue is we don't understand why, in addition to all the structures that deal with safety in the bill, there is a necessity to have this ministerial board of inquiry, because this board will be appointed by the minister. And immediately after the Accident Investigation Board has completed its investigation, this ministerial board will start another investigation. So we are questioning what is the purpose of this ministerial investigation? And if the minister deemed it so important in terms of public pressure, public interest, public concern, we point to Section 82 of the Constitution, which essentially allows the President to appoint a Commission of Inquiry into any matter of public concern, and then the Commissions Act takes over and regulates that Commission of Inquiry. So what we are saying here, again, we've got duplication of inquiries. We've got too many bodies investigating the same thing, and who does what? How do the end results tally together? The last issue that we want to deal with is... Well, it's actually the overlapping issue which I've alluded to. The bill is very unclear as to what accidents this Aviation Safety Investigation Board has jurisdiction to investigate, because the authority also investigates accidents. and it really is not clear who investigates what accidents. Are we? Is this authority going to investigate large accidents where there's loss of life, etc., etc.? It's not clear in the bill, and it again relates to this whole theme of overlapping functions. Who has the authority? Where does it begin? Where does it end? And those are the really only issues around the Aviation Safety Investigation Board. Thanks.
Perhaps it would be perhaps it would be advisable if we've got some comments from the chair, and then we can come in after that.
What I want to do now is say to the Parliament and get some kind of response from them.
That's okay. Okay? You're okay with that?
Chair, as I said, that I've been disadvantaged by not being present
at the previous
week, so yeah, it's yeah. Just a little bit behind.
Ah, okay.
But I'll catch up as the
yeah.
department.
No, I think we're all feeling a little bit like that because yeah. although many of us were present, it was a long time, a while ago. Stuart, just briefly. Yeah?
Just to gain clarity on the last speaker there, where is it clearly, you know, you mentioned the fact that there was not some differential in terms of what was an accident and incident. Now, the way I read it, the powers given to the Aviation Safety Investigation is to deal with both those, and you say not. Can you just tell me where it is, so I can just put my finger on it?
No, you misunderstand what I said. Certainly, the Aviation Safety Investigation Board is required to investigate accidents and serious incidents. My issue is equally, the authority is required to investigate accidents. So which accidents are investigated by the board, the SI board, and which by the authority? Yes. 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 Right.
I just want to check the take of the presenters on, you know, we have amended quite a number of legislations and we put organized labor. I just want to check in section 82 on the composition, whether what is their take on the issue of organized labor to be part of the board.
Is this the board of the authority?
Yes, the board of the authority. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, our position is that the bill sets out very clearly what the requirements are for being appointed to the board. If a member of organized labor happens to have those qualities and is appointed to the board because of those qualities, then obviously that's a... that's a discretion that's been exercised. But we would like to point out that if the purpose of having organized labor there is to lobby for labor on the board, the Labor Relations Act has a myriad of structures which provides organized labor provides to organized labor avenues in which to pursue their issues with the management of the authority. I'm not sure what is the purpose. What is the purpose that an organized labor representative would serve on this board, bearing in mind that this board is a board dealing with matters of civil aviation? There's one further issue that I would also just like to highlight, and that is the potential conflicts of interest that could arise on human resources issues. If a member of organized labor is there, but I still don't understand what benefit would it serve the Civil Aviation Board to have a member of organized labor there who doesn't comply with the requirements of being appointed to the board.
Let's not get into an argument about, I mean, because I think the details around the board let's get to if and, you know, when we've sorted out, if we get to sort out the big issue of why a board, what is the board's function? Because you're saying it's civil aviation matters, but where this is pushing us is in it's corporate governance rather than civil aviation safety and security matters. So that itself needs to be sorted. I mean, just to contextualize, in something like the Rail Safety Regulator, we quite correctly, in my view, insisted on having organized labor present on the board because occupational safety and matters have a direct bearing on the safety of in the rail environment. Whether that applies here is another matter. But let's not dive into that now, okay? Let's go to the department. Let's go to UNWA. But before we dive into the detail, I don't know if you've got with you, but have you actually got what was specifically said in the audits around the principle of existing legislation that could prove to be problematic? Not got it in front of you at the moment. Okay. Okay, let's hear the articulation. But it would be useful maybe if tomorrow or whatever, if we could get, just have us in front, because that's what's driving the hurry and the push and the sense. That's what we've been told in Parliament. We've been told, if we don't do something about this, we're in trouble, flights are going to be cancelled. You know, the kind of problems that you're raising are exactly, the legislation's come to us very late, and we've been generous in creating space in order to listen for this reason, for that reason. So I think a lot of things hinge on that matter. But your recall of what was said.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and may I thank our colleagues across the bench for their submission. We had a lengthy discussion with them, and we've got a long-term relationship with Hayden Davis and the company. And we believe that it's been a fruitful deliberation having that engagement with them as such. But having said that, I think it's important, Mr. Chairman, that we go back and see what were the trigger mechanism in terms of where we are today. South Africa was last audited, aside from the audits last year, back in 1999 by the United States, the Federal Aviation Administration. In that stage, they highlighted a number of concerns, but I think the events of 9/11 superseded those concerns and their focus was placed elsewhere as such. So we had a number of years leading up to last year where issues should have been addressed as such. But obviously, a lot of it starts from legislation. And our legislation is built as such. We've got the Aviation Act of 1962, which is an old act. And while I'm clarifying the issues relating to the audit, I also want to set the record in the submission made by Weber Wenzel in terms of the structure in the past, because that's very important for us to understand. The 1962 Act spoke of a commissioner. Okay. And the commissioner was appointed and reported to the Minister of Transport. Now, it's a very technical act in the sense of the commissioner or the minister made regulations, and flowing out of the regulations, we have civil aviation technical standards, which basically are the nuts and bolts of the industry, how high you should fly, sector, all those kind of issues, and they're quite technical in nature. The problem was that, okay, exactly there wasn't a problem in the sense that there was a direct reporting line, it was within the department as such. So, okay, thank you, sorry. There was no problem at that stage in terms of the reporting structure because the commissioner reported directly to the minister, and it was a very clear-cut operation as such, and it was resident within the Department of Transport. Suffice to say, in 1998, the South African Civil Aviation Act came about, and the act was constructed on the basis that it will create an authority, which is South African Civil Aviation Authority. The authority would have a board. The board would appoint as chief executive officer, and their mandate was to provide oversight for safety and security in civil aviation. Now, one is bearing in mind the reporting lines there, because the South African Civil Aviation Authority has now been tasked with safety and security oversight. They have a board, and more importantly, they have a CEO that's the person that's running the operation. Both ACAIO and the FAA had a problem with this. And I think, given the length of discussion we had earlier on, it clearly could be seen why they had a problem. Firstly, they wanted to know, in terms of the civil aviation technical standards, where do they originate from? Yes, the civil aviation regulations. Who makes those regulations? The consultation with the industry and the reporting line. And the question they raise is, okay, you have a commissioner who basically is the person that should be responsible for this entity. but it's not the person that's in control of the authority. Because in the new Act of 1998, you have the civil aviation authority, you have a board, you have a CEO, etc., etc. And that's where it originated from. Your act, your pieces of legislation are confusing, they're convoluted, we can't really understand who really is the king of the castle. If there's an urgent issue, let's say there's a terrorist threat, what happens then? Do we have to go to a board? Do we have to go into a consultation with the industry before we pass a regulation saying ground this aircraft or ban this aircraft from flying into our airspace? And it was real serious concerns. But flying out of that, there were four other issues which the ACAIO and FAA audit found. And they are normally operational nature, but they stem out of the legislation and thereafter the operational issues. For example, the issues pertaining to manpower. And these are all issues that the board should have taken care of in terms of the technical competencies of the industry. And they felt, you know, it was lucky. So we addressed those last year. And we had the comfort of having Weber Wenzel assist us as well, but in a closed shop environment. And we went through an intervention where a ministerial order was granted where it combined the post of the commission and the CEO into a one-person operation as such. And that gave interim relief, if I may use those words, for the situation on hand, where both the FAA and the CEO, okay. The principle that we applied, though, is, and both parties wanted to see this, ACAIO and the FAA, is that the person that's running this outfit must be a technically competent person. So you can't have, and I'm going to use some extreme words, you can't have a baker coming to run a civil aviation authority, or for that matter, an accountant. There has to be someone, preferably with four stripes on his shoulders, over 10,000-15,000 of flight hours, and has a very lengthy duration in civil aviation with a strong level of integrity. And whilst we may have preached the word democracy earlier on in terms of the discussion, has to be autocratic in nature in terms of if there's a safety issue, decide. I don't have to go and consult with the industry. Yes, after I've decided and rectified the situation, thereafter in terms of long-term engagement, we can consult and get interventions put into place. So that in a nutshell is why the bill is urgent, because the undertaking we gave to both ACAIO and the FAA in particular is that we have an interim measure, but we will address our primary legislation with utmost urgency and rectify this going forward. The ACAIO, being a multilateral organization, we have a periodic audit that can be staged out. With the Federal Aviation Administration, bearing in mind that the reason why they audit or assess other countries, and this is a United States body, is that because we fly into the airspace. And from a legal basis, they need to protect the rights of the citizen. They have had previous incidents and stuff which have gave rise to these international aviation safety assessments which they conduct. So we cannot dictate to them and say, for example, you want to come in 6 months' time, no, you cannot come in 12 months' time. Because the measure they have in place is they can, and as rightfully pointed out by Mr. Davis, is that they could freeze our operating rights, which means that you can't change the aircraft type. They could freeze frequencies. They will not allow you to enter in any other point in the United States, and it would have humongous negative effect on our civil aviation industry. Once they go down that route, the other international agency, the European Aviation Safety Agency, will focus on, because this is how the industry works. It's a global industry, and the one looks at the other regulatory body and see what action they take, and they follow suit as such. So, hence the urgency once again. Now, okay.
I wanted to find out the level of this or this audit in terms of its cut-off times. Is there any time frame associated to having to achieve those objectives that were set? And if so, when is it, so that we can then try and get that into mind in terms of what we're sitting with here in front of us today?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I think there's a two-pronged approach. In ACAIO, we have a framework. And correct me if I'm wrong, Renee, it's sometime mid next year that this legislation would have been promulgated and we have addressed it. With the FAA, we expressed to them that the urgency is such that we'll not stop. If we could have it done this year, we'll have it done this year. Because the challenge we have with the FAA, as I pointed out, is it's a day discretion. If there's another incident in the world that may trigger off an inspection of South Africa, we can't afford to take that risk. And as such, we have to approach this with urgency. Yeah.
Chairman, I think the answer to the question you put forward before is very clearly answered in this document from the CAA, and it answers it in a couple of small paragraphs. If one goes to... Yes. Chairman, if one goes to... One goes to page 2, paragraph 2.1. halfway through the paragraph, the sentence starts, "The board's understanding is that the following are the fundamentals that the FAA was to be happy with for the CAA not to be downgraded from the IASA categorization status. The South African government and the CAA had to, 1, and I think this is your question, effect changes to the primary aviation legislation and regulations for compliance with current oversight regulations, obligations." And then if you go to page 4, on 2.5, it says, "There is nowhere where the FAA specifically says there must be concurrent accountability by the director to the minister and the board. Equally, the FAA does not say that the director must report to the minister. All the FAA wants is accountability by the director for his or her actions." And I think that deals with the two issues of the legislation and the accountability of the director vis-a-vis the minister and the board.
Could I just add very, very briefly, as Anwar said, both the FAA and ICAO had a problem with split responsibility, albeit primarily in the safety context. That's fair. I think that's a fair comment. But the point is, split responsibility is bad. And, you know, if you think back to what we were saying, take, for example, the coordinator, there's a split responsibility. Split responsibility is bad. It's already common cause that that's the case. That's what we're saying. And that really was the key point of the submission.
You know, this thing that we got today now from CAA, are they coming?
They're here.
They're here.
Somewhere, I think.
So we're going to have a look at it just after this presentation, I see.
I also need to get clarity on this document, but it just struck me now. It says South African Civil Aviation Authority, and I know I had a chat with the Chief Executive Officer yesterday, and he wasn't coming. So am I to understand that this is from the Civil Aviation Authority, or is it from the board? Because from the board, I'm not...
Can we just check if there is someone from the board?
Yeah.
I mean, apart from... Yeah.
The submission comes from the board.
Okay. Of which Anwar is a member, but seems to be unaware of the... Okay, anyway. But there's no problem with split. Authority is a problem. Okay, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
It's a little bit complicated because we're just getting the documents.
You know, and obviously it's a bit difficult for us then to know how to... I said earlier that maybe we should look at play, and you've already been played in by your colleagues from over here. Okay. It seems to me that the broad issue, okay, that the two, the ICAO and FAA were raising, is this the danger of being uncertain who was in charge of what, split authority between a commissioner and a CEO, essentially. Okay, we'll come to the board now. Okay. The commissioner was some lurking reality which had kind of barely existed, I think, actually, in practice. It was kind of in the legislation, but didn't exist. It existed in legislation, but was there a commissioner? There was a commissioner.
Actually, that is the lifeblood of the authority. Without a commissioner, you can't operate every
Okay. All right, okay, so there was a commissioner. Exactly, you're right, okay. but a commissioner governed by two bits of legislation which didn't seem to talk to each other. That's the right understanding.
That is correct. The Osaka Act was silent on the commissioner. It spoke to the CEO, which is the 1998 Act.
Right, okay. But there was a commissioner who functioned inside a...
He functioned within the 1962 Act, which is the Aviation Act.
And was located where? In the department?
He was located at the Civil Aviation Authority.
Although he was legally located in the department, as it were.
Yeah.
So kind of...
Chairperson, if I could help you, he was reporting to the minister, commissioner, and should have been independent, but the CAA board was requested by the department some years back to house the commissioner because there wasn't a separate budget for him. He was temporarily put in the CAA.
Okay.
That was an arrangement that was made with the board.
Okay.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, that's an incorrect representation.
Okay.
Because we must look at the SACA Act in terms of the mandate they were given, that it would be responsible for safety and security oversight. And in terms of that, the authority was responsible, given the various annexes in the CAO. As such, the actual real work rested with the commissioner, and he could only operate within the ambit of the South African Civil Aviation Authority. But he had a direct reporting line to the minister.
Okay, that sounds very clear and straightforward, doesn't it? Okay. So there's this muddle which we're trying to sort out, and it's common cause that there was a muddle, is a muddle in the existing principle. No one's denying that. And then there's an issue of exigency, which is a matter which you raise, which is obviously driving, you know, as long as things are ticking over, maybe the problem doesn't surface particularly. It might, but it was a latent problem rather than... But the concern from outside of our shores, but from these important entities that have the power of life and death over our aviation sector, it seems, is what happens in a matter of exigency, and are you... So they're concerned about potential confusion, but a potential confusion in a situation of exigency in particular. So there are two kinds of things, I mean, fundamental things that we've got to try to sort out. Not because they're telling us to, but in any case, they're probably pointing out something that's important. The one is sorting out that confusion, and the other is, in doing that, do we also have the capacity to respond in a situation of exigency, so that there's... Not only do we need to clean up the lines of reporting and so forth, but we also need to have the ability to act quite dramatically. You said with an authoritarian personality or something, but one understood what you mean. Bumping against that is also the nice general, which Sina in particular talked about, progress that we've made with the Civil Aviation Authority Act, which is to be, on the one hand, we were sort of, as it were, diluting some of the authoritarianism that existed before by making sure that we had a more transparent, more inclusive process, particularly through the board, through the Civil Aviation Authority, and through the board structure. Okay, which is in line with much of what we're trying to do. So, though, am I right in trying to understand the balls that we're juggling with, as it were? It's legislation that's problematic, two bits of legislation which create potential problems. The challenge in this area of being able, hopefully never, but if the occasion arises, to be able to move very rapidly. And then the desirability and importance in our new democracy and so on of being inclusive and accommodating a range of skills and abilities and specialization. So those are this is very amateurish, I know, but I'm trying to understand the broad things that we've got to get right, which is maybe why we needed a green paper and a white paper and whatever, so that we had this discussion in that kind of way first before drilling down into too much detail on legislation. Okay. Is anyone disagreeing with generally what I'm saying?
No.
Although so general that maybe it's just hard to disagree with them, maybe.
No, I mean, I'm agreeing it boils down to, I suppose, are we saying a board can't act quickly? Because we
yes.
think it can.
Yes, well, maybe we are saying that.
That's one issue, isn't it, the structured board? And the other issue, it seems to me to become increasingly clear from, I would submit from both perspectives, is the split responsibility is bad, everyone says so, and you can't have a situation of a coordinator doing certain security functions sitting out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
I mean, those are the two issues. And I would submit the latter has become quite crystal clear, and as far as the former is concerned, to say you don't need a board, if the motivation is to act speedily, then you have to assume that boards are incapable of not acting speedily. Well, I mean, everyday corporate life would be evidence to the contrary.
Okay, depends which corporate life you're referring to.
I agree with your point as well.
In the land of FAA and so on, there's some current examples.
Mr. Chairperson, just to maybe add one more thing to that, is that the reason why we in fact got into a muddle initially is that we had the 1999 or 1980 Aviation Act that created the commissioner position, and then we moved to authority position. Again, that authority act, I was advised, and it could be mistaken, but I was advised, was drafted in a matter of 30 days. By practically people with accounting experience, because they thought it was revenueable. And all I'm saying is learn from our mistakes, is that you cannot rush something that will have unintended consequences. Understand the exigency issues. But the exigency provisions do exist in our current legislation. We proved it to the FAA when they came down. We proved that a lot of their concerns were misplaced, because our legislation, on the whole, yes, had deficiencies, but legislation around the world, we could point holes in theirs as well, would have. And we undertook, yes, we would address, would have a major overhaul of our legislation, and they acknowledged that an overhaul takes time. However, they need a comfort in short-term measures and interim-term measures. So what that means, I mean, you know, it could mean many things in my mind. It could mean we could have localized amendments to the current legislation with the aim of doing a massive overhaul. Now, just on one point, I'll tell you one example of an unintended consequence that has nothing to do with safety and security oversight. One burning issue, and Hayden could maybe speak to that, is, for example, that issue right at the top, the wide definition of registered owner that's used. That unintended consequence has a massive impact on our aviation finance industry in this country. So it's got nothing to do with aviation, it's more of a commercial issue. Unintended consequence is that it could affect us commercially. Because what this seems to suggest, and I understand we had a big debate with the Department of Transport on Friday as to what they try to achieve, and I appreciate what they're trying to achieve, but it actually works against, say, the industry players. Because of the strict liability on very innocent parties to a commercial transaction in a leasing arrangement environment. Those are the type of issues that are not well thought of. A rushed job is going to, in my view, land us in a bigger mess than we even had before. And my other point that I just want to make crystal clear is that if it was the intention to address all of the shortcomings that was raised in historical audit reports, why is this bill such a fundamental mess on those main issues? The overlapping of functions, the creating of the myriad of, you know, centers of power. And I'll tell you why. Because it's just humanly impossible to take and these myriads of acts, think about the policy considerations, consider world best practice on an evolving industry, and do a bill, and I believe the first bill was drafted in an impossible time frame, of similar time frame, of 30 days. 30 days to 45 days, the first draft came out. It has improved considerably, granted. I'm not going to take credit for that, but maybe because of quick submissions from the industry. But To be honest with you, I really think more thought needs to go into this. I think we can deal with exigency situations. We can maybe do localized amendments to make absolutely sure that in the event of a disastrous, you know, accident, we have a clear line of authority. But maybe a more longer-term view on this bill should be taken into account.
Just to recap on what's been said there, which I think is the crucial issues here in terms of timing, we have sort of programmed for this thing to be read in the House and debated on the 22nd. That's next week on Wednesday. Now, I'm just thinking now of the implication of the 105-page presentation from ASSA and the, you know, what we're sitting in front of us here. And the opening ambit when you started debating your clients, you know, concerns was that there was a lot of consensus that was agreed to on Friday. And I assume the department must confirm that that consensus of all those, we must take them out and agree that if they have accepted them, that they're going to be incorporated into the new bill that as it stands in front of us. But this, the big issue were the 2 points of the centre of powers, I understand it, and the roles and functions of the coordinator and the overlapping of the of that and the aviation board. I was just, you know, thinking maybe the department should, you know, look at that clearly as to how it complies with the requirement of the order and see whether they are satisfied with the proposal that's been put forward, which is still outstanding relating to this organogram. And if so, whether they then would be prepared to consider this, because they're going to need more time than us with doing the amendments than us agreeing to those amendments, because we haven't seen sight of the, and we're not consciously aware of a lot of the conventions that apply here. I was just going to Chair ask them whether the department wouldn't say that they are prepared to go away and to sit and look at this aspect with the presentation that's been put forward, and to see where there is that consensus and where it complies particularly to the requirement of the audit, and come back to us, you know, with a, say tomorrow morning, with something that we can say, look, we've agreed on this. These are the outstanding items we now are not agreeing. Because from what I gather, you know, a lot of the stuff, there's a lot of people saying the same thing. We haven't read the CAA one, but if I go through there, from the board of directors, there seems to be a lot of commonalities that have been raised. So it is not something that, you know, has just been pulled out of the sky, so to speak. So could I just maybe, through you, Chair, ask whether the department is still stuck on this, and why they're stuck on this issue of the proposals that are the two outstanding issues, the centre of power and the roles and functions that are over there.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I feel like someone somewhere in the air, somewhere between Johannesburg and Cape Town, but not knowing exactly where I am. The presentation come out with substantial differences, substantial criticism on the bill. I thought the department would answer on those substantial concerns that we heard now. I didn't hear that.
Well, I haven't given them a chance.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Because I think the department perhaps should attempt to answer those substantial differences and concerns that we had in this.
Chair, also I want to check in terms of submission, how many submissions the department received, whether this is the only submission that they received, and whether there were any other submissions.
But then, if we could then begin to zoom in then on the two and perhaps three substantial issues that have been raised, and give us a sort of broad sense of what your take is on those matters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, as the Honourable Member pointed out, there's been a huge level of criticism leveled in terms of the bill and how we proceeded. And whilst I may not want to engage in the oval in how long it took and who constructed it, I think it's important that we reflect that we had audits last year. They did find significant findings as such, and we need to respond promptly to those findings, because in the arena of global civil aviation, where things change by the second, and we have to respond immediately as such. Now, on those three issues that have been pointed out, the three key issues, it's important to begin that this is an industry that's very time-centered. Whilst we have quoted regulators, and we've quoted SAMHSA and all the other agencies in both the submission and in oral format, they don't have the benefit, or they have the added benefit of time against this industry. And that is the basis on which both ACAIO, the FAA, and other international aviation safety agencies globally are moving towards a structure that responds on time as such. And we need to look at there is a sample structure on the web for the Federal Aviation Administration in terms of how a bill should be structured to respond on time. And rightfully pointed earlier on, Australia previously did have a board, and knowing that they are a Commonwealth country and the Commonwealth is very strong on boards, have dissolved the board and moved in line where you have one person that controls the authority and reports directly to the minister. Now, in 1998, when the SACA Act came about, there were a number of other acts that came about, Mr. Chairman and honourable members. And all those acts brought about the number of entities, which I think we can all comfortably say today, need to have a look at in terms of whether they require a board or don't require a board, or what role does the board actually play in those entities. This is one such entity. In 1998, SACA was created, in 1999, the PFMA came about. And everyone focused on PFMA because of the accountability aspect and the financial control aspects as such. And when one looks at the submission made by Weber Wenzel, they make reference to the PFMA and the quote section 49. But only part of the section is quoted. And one needs to read in totality, which will give this House an understanding of perhaps which direction we need to go. And if I may, at the liberty of the members, just read out section 49. And it says quite clearly, accounting authorities, subsection 1, every public entity must have an authority which must be accountable for the purposes of this Act. Subsection 2, if the public entity A has a board or other controlling board, that board or controlling board is accounting authority for that entity. That's where W will be stopped in terms of the presentation. Subsection 2B reads, does not have a controlling body, the chief executive officer or the other person in charge of the public entity is the accounting authority for that public entity, unless specific legislation applicable to that public entity designates another person as the accounting authority. Now, PFMA allows us the liberty of either having a board and an accounting authority, or allowing the CEO of other party, whether it's a director, commissioner, whatever, to be the accounting authority. So we have some direction in terms of PFMA. Now, the reason why the department went down the line of this structure, and as pointed out by Zina Dasa from WWB, who worked on this task when we had the audit of corrective actions, was that we clearly, and the word came across, which is a word that she's quite accustomed to, is we need to delineate the responsibilities and show clearly that the commissioner for CEO is totally in control of safety and security oversight of the entity, and that the board is in control of the corporate governance aspects of the entity as such. And that was written into a ministerial order, which is public information by any case. So this is how it's structured. Now, we need to ask ourselves a simple question, and as the honourable member pointed out, maybe the department needs to go back and deliver it, but I think we can address that right now. What is the core business, or I won't use the word business, but what is the core purpose of the authority? It's a very simple answer to this, and that is to provide safety and security oversight in terms of ACAIO and the various annexes. In terms of revenue stream, the revenue is derived from the flying passenger, where you pay in a levy to fly, as well as there are certain charges in terms of your pilot's license, etc., etc. So there's a very fixed revenue stream, of course, variable, but you can see where your money is coming from. You don't go into offshore investments or put capital expenditure in other parts of such a business. Now, if that was the business, one could then say, okay, fine, the board needs to play a role from a strategic point of view, because of the strategic direction that the board needs to give for those kind of investments and such. In terms of everyday operation, this is an entity that, and I want to use the word again, needs to be autocratic in nature in terms of making sure that the rules and the laws of the air are applied day in, day out, minute by minute. Okay. But then the entity has a very formalized consultation process which wasn't discussed again in any submission. And that is the entity, before making regulations, has a CARCOMS process, which is Civil Aviation Regulations Committee. It consults with industry. That consultation process then lends itself out into a draft regulation which goes up to the Ministry and obviously gets passed on. Flowing from those regulations, you get the Civil Aviation Technical Standards. So there is no area in which the industry is not involved in terms of constructing regulations, bringing into Civil Aviation Technical Standards. But once the rules are made, then that consultation process falls away, because then you need to apply the rules as written out as such. And that is the kind of control which both ACAIO and the FAA want to see on a day-to-day basis, that the person that is in charge of the Civil Aviation Authority can apply the Civil Aviation Regulations, the Civil Aviation Technical Standards, without any fear or prejudice or interference by any party, including that of the minister who has appointed him. Now, we have heard the submission in terms of the New Zealand model. And the New Zealand model, yes, they do talk about a board, but there is an express provision that states in the New Zealand model that the director must act independently and is not responsible to the minister or the authority in respect of any particular cases relating to his functions. So there's a very express provision made in the New Zealand model that gives him that independence to operate. But yes, they do have a board. Australia had a similar mechanism, but as I said earlier on, they dissolved the board. Now, the reason why we looked at saying, okay, fine, you need to have a board, the corporate governance, whatever, so, okay, give comfort to the fact that we had an order, and just give comfort to the fact that there's a corporate governance issue that the board can play a role on. But if one has to go into the future and looking at what the PFMA says, it still leaves our hands free in saying, fine, if it's a one-person model, and if the director reports directly to the minister, whether it's the Auditor General, whether it's another public entity or another oversight unit, can oversee the corporate governance issue. And it's very simple. You have money coming in, you're spending on inspectors, you're spending on surveillance. There's nothing strategic about it. Of course, one needs to ensure that the performance agreement which the director signs with the minister must be tacit and strong enough to hold the minister to accountability in terms of how he operates the industry as such.
Okay, now part of our problem, obviously, is there's a position that you're inclining towards now. There's a position from over on this side. And then there's the bill in front of us, which is a whole third position. And part of the problem is some of their criticism is related to the bill as it stands, and not necessarily to what you're saying. And so on. So it's very hard for us in the midst of this three-part tug, and obviously when we get into details it might get even more complicated, but just in terms of the broad structure of what we're trying to do, this envisages a board, and the board is essentially, although the wording might be quite wrong, and I think that's what you've been pointing out, it's obviously nudging it in the direction of corporate governance. Okay. But if that's where we want to go, then we need to get the wording better. That isn't where you want to go, but if that's where, that's the position. Where you're leaning now is the second paragraph in the PFMA, the second relevant paragraph in the PFMA. Why do authorities of this kind, which are not transnets, borrowing large amounts of money, or ESCOMs or something, they don't need boards in terms of the PFMA. That we need to make sure that this consultation with the industry is absolutely important. It can't be just whimsical decisions made by, forgive the term, bureaucrats, or, you know. Needs to be buy-in, participation, and engagement. And we need to make very sure that that's happening, and you assure us that it is, that's something we would need to be clear about. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is it's very hard for us to proceed in general, because it's a complicated area. But secondly, because what we've got and what you're saying are two different things.
Yes.
Fundamentally different.
Exactly.
Things. So it makes our task very difficult here. Okay, yeah, Anna. Let's take Anna and then I'll come to you. John.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, it's in response to the final model proposed by ASA in terms of the board has total control, and I'm just giving the converse in terms of the argument. Now, my colleague here pointed out that, and I also looked at the model when we had discussion, that was the nub of the finding in terms of having too many parties within a board with executives, non-executives. You know, the whole full business type of board that you get, which runs the angle bar, the sector, that's not really required for the industry. And I think that's what you
John, thank you. There is another document which we haven't studied, just the CAA document, and I've just been reading the conclusions because I have not seen it before today. One of the conclusions is that a comparative study on aviation legislation in page 28, the last paragraph, says a comparative study on aviation legislation in other parts of the world and member states of the ICAO was not done prior to the drafting of the legislation. This would have provided a good and solid background to the civil aviation bill. Then it says aviation legislation inter alia, the United Kingdom and the United States, would have given the drafters a good opportunity to explore how other civil aviation authorities are regulated.
Yeah, it's like as you have indicated that it's becoming a little bit difficult, and it has actually been difficult for me right at the beginning. Probably that's why I've actually requested to be clarified that whether the department and the business sector in the civil aviation have actually differed and resolved to differ. If not, and then we're supposed to be hearing, you know, it's from the department, how they can come closer as far as already are. But one is not hearing that, and we are still hearing the department explaining how they got the things in the bill, but irrespective of actually responding to what the business is saying. And I find it very difficult, Chair, that whether we really do have to apply our minds seriously, even if the department and the business have not yet reached a deadlock of agreeing on certain things. Because if one gets an understanding that they have resolved to differ, then one understands the kind of effort that we need to be putting to actually bringing the two different versions together towards the final document. But if they have not resolved to differ, that means on their own the department and the business still has room to actually find each other and actually reduce the much difficulties that we have to find ourselves in trying to coordinate this legislation. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairperson, just one comment on, it's fine and well to articulate a position now, which bears it has no roots in what you're looking at. I mean, what the department is proposing now is not what is reflected in the bill, and I think you raise it. I mean, it's a completely different model. Our big criticism is that you're putting the cart before the horse. You are reacting to what you know, hastened criticisms are, of, you know, general criticisms are. And you're reacting, and then you're formulating quick answer positions which are not well thought out. With all due respect, what should be done here is a comparative international best practice study, and it has not been done by any measure. We tried doing it for the FAA at the FAA audit time, and we were hampered because of insufficient information. And you know, sometimes when things are written on paper in other jurisdictions, that's not practically how things pan out in practice. That type of study needs to be done. You need a policy position. I mean, what he's proposing now, we haven't seen it. We can't even criticize it at this point. We just reacted what we thought they may want to do. And they responded by saying, yes, now we're going this route. I mean, the mere comment is saying that we actually did not quote the entire section of the PFMA. We weren't obliged to do that because that position was never put to our clients before. What we had was a board position, and we commented on the board issue that's relevant in this PFMA. So, you know, it's all, you know, fine and well to articulate a particular policy now, but that policy is not reflected anyway. It wasn't reflected in your April bill. It's certainly not reflected here. In fact, whatever you're saying, it's just, I mean, do you defend this current bill? Do you defend the structure of the current bill in relation to those two major issues? I think that's what we need to know. Are you abandoning it? Are you going back to the drawing board? Are you proposing a new structure? Is there going to be certainty around your policy that we can react to? Or, I mean, I just think it's just useless to do this.
Okay. Mr. Kim.
Chair, you know, I have a very serious difficulty. And I don't want to find myself like Honorable Moss between in Johannesburg and Cape Town. I want to find myself in Parliament in E249. And we met with Department Chair. We had a draft bill. We said to them there's going to be a submission. Submission was then been made. And I asked earlier on whether, what is this company? Whether it's only this company that has made submission. And Weber Benson, whether it's only this company that has made submission. And if the answer is yes, what is their comment in the submission that has been made? And if also CAA has made their submission, what is department saying in the submission that has been made? If there's any other stakeholder that has made submission, what is their take? What is the department take on those submissions? Clearly, Chair, there's nothing that department is telling us. Is there a chance now to say to us, we have received number of submissions, 1, 2, 3, and these are the comments from department. And I don't find it now. And I want Chair for department to assist us, to all of us, to be in E249, in Parliament. They must address us, how many submissions they received, and where are other submissions, if there's any. And also, what is their take on those submissions that has been submitted? Thank you, Chair.
Let's specifically follow your latter point. And let's take then systematically the two, perhaps three issues, broad principle issues that have been raised, and hear whether you agree or disagree fundamentally with the issues that have been raised in the PowerPoint presentation for which we got. Do you agree or not that in the current bill we've got multiple centres of power and that could cause problems? Do you think that's a fair or unfair comment?
I think the point Mr. Chairman raised with regards to the National Safety, National Aviation Security Coordinator, and I look at the annex, the annex does not say specifically, let's say, Archive Annex, where the Archive Annex for safety for security does not specifically state where the National Aviation Security Coordinator should reside. So it could be either here or there. And having heard the submission from WWP, it's a workable, you know, solution. It would not. What
others are saying, I'm saying, if we turn to that, let's go to the very first organogram, which was, I think, the third slide. Right. Okay. So what we've got up there is an organogram which suggests that there are multiple centres of responsibility and of reporting. Okay, so you've got a coordinator who's a staff member, who accounts to a DG and via the DG to the minister, who's appointed by the minister. You've got a director reporting independently of the board, but housed in the CAA. And then you've got a board also appointing and accountable to a minister. Okay. And the first problem potentially arises as between the coordinator and the director, and in an overlap between functions. Okay, and the same applies. Now, are those fair criticisms or unfair criticisms?
Mr. Chairman, I think I need to respond looking at the diagram and talk to the diagram.
Yes.
Walk away through. Having spoken about the FAA assessment and looking at the diagram, and Sina Das has kept on referring to we, which was part of the Department of Transport. The solution arose that long term, or well, interim, the director, and which is the combination of this commissioner slash CEO, has to be completely delineated from the board as such. Board can do the corporate governance issue. Now, if we have to have a model as such, and that the board and the duties of the board and the duties of the director, there must be a clear delineation in terms of who's responsible for what. The one responsible for safety oversight and the other responsible for the corporate governance. Okay. Now, when it says that model in terms of if we have to have an assessment, safety assessment of the country. The fact that the director is responsible for the civilization regulation process and makes the regulations and he's in charge of safety oversight and security oversight, we would have a clear line of reporting. The international party is not interested in terms of the corporate government issue. That's an inside arrangement for South Africa. So as a model, as it's portrayed in the bill, we talk about the minister, director, authority and the board, it's a workable model. Without a board. Because as I said, the corporate government is the inside. Now, if you look on the left-hand side of the model in terms of the coordinator, okay, the requirement by ACAIO in terms of security is for the presentation of a national aviation safety program. And that national aviation safety program gives guidance to national aviation safety plans filed by different airports and aerodromes, etc. If that position, as I said, does not identify itself in terms of where it should be resided in ACAIO, because remember there are 10 recommended practices, if it resides within the CAA reported to the director, there's no harm in doing so, and it answers your question, can reside within the CAA?
Yes, it can.
If it resides outside, it's still in compliance with ACAIO, so it's not a year no day.
So that would be something that would
we could look at.
And what would be the
I cannot see any material disadvantage.
Located, but would be, and obviously there are material advantages if what Weber Wenzel is saying, namely that the coordinator, as things stand, has no resources, no department as such, which is why we went for that option earlier with the commissioner. Would the coordinator, the director, be different people?
Yes, the coordinated diet will be different people.
Different functions. And that difference would be based on the one develops a program and the other one operationalizes the program.
The one
so
is, yeah.
We are actually having to work out here. The diet is overall responsible
for oversight as such. Now, the National Aviation Security Coordinator, and we are all aware that the CAA has got a security function within its control, would ensure that the National Aviation Safety Program is formulated and that the National Aviation Safety Program is implemented on shop floor level, that is, with the various airports, sectors, etc. In terms of decision making for regulations, the director's person is accountable. So there will be still a one man operation, except that the National Security Coordinator will be reported to the director as a functionary. Wouldn't see it.
Okay. But would you agree that what was said is that in describing the roles of those two entities, the two persons, as it were, coordinator and director, leaving aside the location of the coordinator, that there appear to be overlaps in the wording? I mean, wording can be sorted out if one's clear what one's trying to do with the wording, but would you agree that there are some problems there which was raised? Okay. Okay. Maxwell.
So I have a question and a proposal.
Yes.
I need to know if the department, did they get these submissions beforehand or is it the first time? That's the question. And I will then recommend that the department go and look at these submissions and try to reply to them one by one as the questions came and come back to us. That's my proposal, sir.
I'm trying to... I agree. I think that's where we're going, okay? That is where we're going. But but I don't want to get... I want us to try to help the department by posing some salient issues that we want them to look at. So that we are also clear ourselves what it is that we're expecting to do, because they will have seen the major input they've been interacting with in a variety of forms over a period of time. And we've heard they've had a recent meeting once more again to look at the things. But it strikes me, listening to the two parties, that that although they agreed on some detail, the overall structure of what is trying to be achieved is not the there's difference between the two parties, and even a difference between the bill in front of us and the different positions of the two parties. And that's what we're struggling with. So I think we need to try to be quite specific about what it is that would be useful. So and maybe okay, so we've talked about that. The accident investigation issue, Aviation Safety Investigation Board, again, there seems to be confusions around its independence, its non-independence, and then a different kind of investigation that also happens, a Ministerial Board of Inquiry, and what the difference is and so on. That may be something that's in the detail that we can sort out. It's more, I think, these lines of reporting and structures and what has what responsibility that remains still confusing. Am I right in thinking that? Okay. Anwar?
Sorry, I think we just want to address the accident safety investigation board. Okay.
Let's get that in too. I suspect that's something that we can, just looking in the details, more the big structure. Okay. So can we try to be... And let me say right at this stage, I think that we may be running out of time here. I mean, I don't mean now today, I mean in this parliament, okay. But I'm aware of the pressures to try so we want to be as accommodating as possible, but I think also we need time out as members just to also think what we want to suggest. But before we get there too quickly, can we suggest to the department that you come with a clean set of proposals of a general kind? Let's not drill into too much of the detail, because I think we get into the detail too quickly and then spend too much time on that. Surely it's desirable for the coordinator to be, if we need a coordinator, and you're saying there is that requirement in terms of international conventions and auditing and so forth, then surely the coordinator should be housed within the CAA, within the authority, and not within the department. And in practice, that's what's happening. But let's legislate for that. So if you can help us, if you agree with that, and no one's disagreeing with that, if you could begin to produce some wording that helps us to, then we would certainly like to hear how the key stakeholders, the industry basically, are to be included in the process. You say there's already inclusion in terms of the development of regulation and so forth. That we want reassurances on that. Then we can look at the board matter. And we're hearing one proposal, which is they'd like the board as it is, beefed up, some details maybe. The aviation, the bill pushes it in the direction of being a corporate, which they don't want, which strikes me as being redundant, not really needed, which strikes you as being redundant. If that's where it's going, so you might as well drop it. So let's more cleanly begin to say that, if that's where you want to go, and then we'll debate the pros and cons of the two. Bearing in mind that we're all wanting transparency, we're wanting inclusion, we're wanting to have buy-in and want to benefit from the professional skills. So, aviation skills, not so much the corporate skills, the aviation skills of key private sector stakeholders. Okay. Now, I don't know if you're going to be able to pull all of that off by way of what we're now beginning to talk about, draft legislation. Now, some of it will already be here, and some of it might not be, but I think that's what we need. And I'm not hearing you disagree. Okay, because in a sense you're wanting to not walk away from everything here, but you're wanting to walk away from the structure proposed here. Yeah. In regard to the board, in regard to coordinator, director. Okay. But you want to say more? Yeah?
No, I want to say more. I think I just want to address you on the second point you raised in regard to having the comfort that the industry should be involved. And I think we did discuss this earlier this morning. The civil aviation regulations process as such, and we can include that in the primary legislation. Then it's a done deal in terms of involvement of the industry.
Sorry. We're saying, as we're saying earlier, that in the regulation development process, there's inclusion, and the proposal there is that we should even look at putting that, not just being a custom or what's done, but actually writing it into legislation could then also perhaps more effectively answer what you're looking for in a board. I don't know, that's also but certainly that's a comfort we would want to make sure, because we certainly hear the point about the need to, for not to become, and I'm not saying that's what you are, but to become narrowly bureaucratic in these matters and hidden away. Okay. Now, any other members want to say anything at this point? Because basically, I think we can play in the board's presentation, but let's give ourselves a chance to read it properly and so on. Because I think it's not going to take us. We've got a sort of paradigm issue that we've got to sort out first before we plunge in. And I'm suspecting, unless you would like to say something at this point,
No.
The direction we're kind of nudging the department in line with the kinds of questions you want to see opened up here.
No, maybe the only point that I can raise at this point in time is the concern raised by actually in our submission, page 2 of the submission of the board.
So okay. Page 2? Just tell us what they are.
Page 2.1.1.
Have you got your...
Page 2 of the submission from the Board of South African Civil Aviation Authority. It's page
is 2.1.1 to 2.1.6. The first one is deals with primary aviation legislation and regulations. And the second one,
these are the audit requirements,
because obviously, Chair, if we don't address this in our aviation legislation, we are definitely going to be found wanting again. So we have to use this opportunity to address all these findings. Otherwise, it is really a futile exercise. It won't serve any purpose, Chair, if we deal with the removal of the board and we fail to deal with the core concerns and core findings raised, you know, by the audit.
We're not doing away with the board yet, okay, or maybe ever. But the one that applies to us fundamentally is 2.1.1. The rest are all issues that are practical measures that need to be undertaken, which we're aware of from interacting with the CAA over some years. Belatedly, I should say, the CA board never told us about the unfavourable audits that were received earlier on. Never told us. But to the credit of the current board, I think it was the board or the department, we were told of that most recently. We are aware of those. Most of those others are not really things that we should legislate for particularly, maybe, but maybe not. I mean, maybe they're in describing the functions or responsibilities or whatever, those are the sorts of things we also need to look at. But fundamentally, it's 2.1.1 that becomes our challenge. And what's driving this, essentially, was this observation, 2.1.1. So we are to reassure you, we're very mindful of that. Obviously, any decision about how to structure the CA or restructure the CA in terms of boards or whatever would then need also to bear in mind what the CA has to do and whether having a board, not having a board is going to help it or not help it to fulfill those functions of the kind that I mentioned under the other 2.1.2 and so on. Okay, so I suspect that we're sort of coming to an end for the morning. I'm not sure that we can do much more useful business. Offensive.
Earlier on, I raised a question on number of submissions. Is it difficult for that question to be answered by department? Please.
Submissions received.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I was not trying to be evasive.
No. I kept steering you away from that answer.
Yeah. Sorry. We received submissions from WW on behalf of us and ACS, which is one submission.
Which is the one we've had today?
A submission from ALPA, which is the Airline Pilots Association. Okay. Those submissions, and we incorporated them in the bill.
Okay.
After that, and the CA itself,
that
we bought by the CA itself.
Right.
After that, and very lately, in the last couple of days, we received a submission from an individual representing pertaining to taxis.
Yes, which has nothing to do with what we're here. It's about taxi ranks at airports, which is an endless problem.
And we received an updated version from ASA, from WW, it went from 17 pages to 102 pages, which is the current one. Okay. We received this morning a submission from a bar members from the Cape Town Bar Association, and we now received a submission from the Board of the South African Conservation Authority. And those are submissions.
The most substantial and expanding one is the one that we've listened to today. Okay. Okay.
Was from the Commercial Aviation Society. Now, that's got nothing to do with you, or is it a client of yours?
That's quite correct. The Commercial Aviation Association represents general aviation as opposed to scheduled airline operations.
Well, there was just a minimal problem with low-flying aircraft over the environmental park areas or something like that.
Let me look at all the other, including the taxi rank one, just to satisfy our minds that it may or may not have relevance. But what I don't want to do is to plunge too much into detail around low-flying aircraft or whatever until we've begun to get a better sense of the organogram that we're debating, first of all, because even that hasn't been so clear. And then the desirability of making one or another option. Lemmy, and then I'll come to John.
Yeah, Chairperson, I think you are really assisting us to get forward. And Juan just wanted to add to your direction that the department go back and do that particular exercise, and let us encourage a little bit higher interaction with the other partners in the industry in trying to shape up something else, and really remove all the smaller little obstacles and come up with the visionary structure of the authority that we would like to see. And also, after crafting it, and have that kind of a visionary picture of how the animal is actually going to function in terms of reporting lines, accountabilities, and responsibilities, so that we really don't come back here, you know, to be shown things that we would not really celebrate when they have been shown to us, in terms of confusion and conflict, and have that particular view of the kind of authority, and higher interaction with the role players while they are actually doing that probably will assist us to get closer to the final legislation that we will be able.
About accountability related to those individuals, if we'd like to put them like that, reporting to the minister. As far as we're concerned from the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, we can hold the CAA accountable. We call them here for the annual reports. We call them here to, you know, have oversight over the expenditure, their roles and functions. I'm just trying to think of the accountability that we might have in respect of those appointees, you know, going to the minister per se, particularly in light of some of the PFMA things that you mentioned, Anwar, and it's just a thought that's come through, because clearly if there's a prank out there or an incident, there's got to be money and resources called it immediately to be able them to investigate and to go out and do those functions. I think it was raised as well as one of your concerns. And now accounting for those sort of monies, let's talk at that are flowing into those type of things through an individual. I don't know whether we would be able to get down, even through the Auditor General's process, to be able to directly hold somebody to account there. And I'm raising that just as some of the thoughts to motivate the thinking that's coming from that side about how to structure this thing. You know, you can have as many people there as you want in the individual capacity, but at the end of the day, you know, how do you actually, you know, as Parliament, I'm talking from our side, from Parliament, how do we hold them accountable?
Chairperson, I'd just like to clarify one point, and that is that Weber Wenzel are here today representing two clients. One is the Airline Association, which is basically the airlines of South Africa. The second one is ACS, which is a company that's owned jointly by the airlines of South Africa and the foreign airlines. So to the extent that we are seeking to see how broad the representation is in terms of responses, it does have and does include the foreign airlines as well. They are in agreement with the points that have been made here. So it is fairly broad, the representation. The other point I wanted to make was that Maheng is the company secretary of the CAA, made the point quite well, I thought, that when we looked at these various 6 points that were raised here regarding the FAA report, the one issue is the change in the legislation. I think we all respect that. And that could be partly compensated by the other processes that Anwar made, where regulations are made. But there are a whole lot of other things which are not regulations. They are programs for safety and oversight and so on. That's not done by the regulatory body. That's something that would need to be done by the CAA and driven by its board.
I have to respond to that, and it's clearly here. I think what you need to understand me clearly is that the subdivision regulating process, as I said, will include in the bill as prime legislation. Now, with reference to these points over here, point number one is with regards to legislation. All the other points, as rightfully summarized by the chairperson, have been addressed. That is why in earlier this year we went through a reassessment of the FAA, and all of these points have been ticked off. There's surveillance programs, the inspector levels are the right numbers, a formal program for the resolution of identified safety issues, all of that is in place currently. We have a very healthy CAA.
To try and hog the last word, provisional last word, okay, because this is a process. And without preempting anything else, one, we've got very little time allowed to us by Parliament itself in terms of meeting as committees. Okay? The anticipation is that there will be, I don't think, any legislation next year. There's November, there's the remainder of October and November in order to get stuff to the House. Okay. And I'm a bit worried that in practice, certainly a lot of what I've been saying, which is no doubt very misguided and ill-informed, but is of a kind of white paper kind of thing. Okay, I liked your point earlier. Maybe that's everyone else is very clear, and it's me that's not so clear. But I'm not sure that the kind of broad paradigm ducks are in a row quite yet. Okay. So, in addition to the kind of broad tasks, which I suspect are of a kind of white paper type kind. And where a number of questions, like Stuart's, one of Stuart's earlier questions, were it's useful for us to also, without having a cringe about ourselves, useful to have a sense of what's going on in other countries. Is there not? Because also looking at the legislation, I think we're trying in the bill that we've got. It seems like we're trying to solve all the problems in all kinds of directions. And I know it's complicated when you're dealing with it's complicated enough with one bit of legislation. If it's then any amendment then has all kinds of consequential spin-offs. But dealing with two bits of legislation, what if we went for just a fairly small provisional holding bit of legislation, which address the main problem that's coming up in the audit, which I suspect relates to the coordinator director thing, that they want some kind of coordinator. Okay, we'll give them a coordinator. How do we do that in a short piece of legislation, which is manageable for us, manageable for you, hopefully. And then we come around in another parliament to deciding whether we still need a board, how we describe the functions of the board, etc., etc., etc. Is that a possibility?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to take it back to the department and respond to you. If it's possible.
Our advice is starting to be that, okay, that it's either going to be something quite surgical and modest as a kind of doing something we want to do, but it's not all the things we want to do on this terrain, and then we all need more time, and obviously then you'll be dealing probably with the new parliament, but to carry through the much more radical surgery or whatever, because I suspect if we don't go for a small intervention, we're not going to make it, because already part of the delay has been that the legislation, because that hasn't been raised, but it sat for a long time with the state with the law advisors. Long, long, long time before getting sick. I can begin to see now why that might have been the problem. No. I'm saying that it was complicated. It was complicated, wasn't it? Not a finger being pointed at yourselves, a delay at all. Just that it's very, and refers to many other conventions and so on. It is problematic. Okay. Then maybe, certainly as the ANC study group, we need to, because I'm just making it up as I go here now, but I mean, on the basis of what I'm hearing, but I also need the satisfaction, and just as you need to report to your principals, Anwar, I think in a multi-body wise, but also perhaps as ANC, would also just check whether what I'm saying is acceptable. So when can we come back? We've got slots tomorrow, Thursday, and so on. Would you prefer to make it Thursday than Wednesday, or next week? We can make it next week. We have got space. Should we do it next week? Tuesday next week. And so we scrub the hearings, because we're not ready to proceed into detail and so on at this point.
The department decides, together with your study group or whatever, that it carries on in its present form, then we must consider this thing for November, I think, rather than next week, Wednesday, because that's not going to happen.
The, whatever, League of Government Assistance and so on, I think. Yeah. Okay, so in a sense we're saying two things. The one is, come back with a clean proposal around what we're trying to do, so it's on paper. See whether that can be driven through this with minor alterations, obviously looking at the detail. Fallback position, I think more realistic, is some kind of just some tweaks that get the lines of command better described, but answer the requirements of the thing without trying to do too much all at once. Okay, so we'll meet on Tuesday. You can obviously be in touch with us if you can, and any other members of the public, but if yourself, you could be, we'd appreciate if you could be. We'll obviously stay in touch and see whether Tuesday becomes feasible or not, or Wednesday or whatever, but we would appreciate your presence. Certainly it would help us doing justice to it. And there's some skepticism on that side about it, but about what I've just said. But even though, well, you admit that you talk, it's important. Okay. Okay. So thanks very much, everyone. Thanks for the input.